Please join me in 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse number 10, where we are looking at the second official coronation of King Solomon by King David, the event at which David encourages his young son to trust God and depend upon the people and the leadership to help him in his kingdom. But also, David addresses the people as a whole and tells them to get behind King Solomon and encourage him and assist him and to donate to the cause of building the temple of God, the palace of God on the Temple Mount. And David went over the value of everything that he has already donated, already put in storage, and it was in the billions of dollars worth of material already, and tons and tons, hundreds of tons of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood. And then he asked the people to donate, and they donate even more. And lots and lots of precious stones that are also donated for the building of this temple. And I shared with you again as we were closing up yesterday that if you take all the material that eventually gets listed as part of the construction of the temple project, it's worth trillions of dollars. And if you add into it all the high-tech labor that is going to be used in building this temple, that I'm pretty certain that this was the most expensive building per cubic foot that has ever been built on planet Earth. And if it had not been destroyed by the Babylonians in 587, because of the sins of Israel, it would have been on the list of the wonders of the ancient world. Now, David is continuing his address of the people on this day, probably, I think, in the seventh month of the 37th year of his reign. And he's wrapping things up now. So 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 10. Therefore, David blessed he who is in the presence of all the people. So he offers this public prayer. David said, "Blessed are you, O he who is the God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever. Yours, O he who is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty, for all that is in the heavens and in the earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O he who is, and you are exalted as head above all." So that's some very direct praise and honor given to God by David. "Both riches and honor come from you, and you rule over all. In your hand are power and might, and in your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. And now we thank you, our God, and praise your glorious name." What a marvelous way to start his prayer to God. And then he makes this interesting confession. "Who am I? What is this people that we should be able thus to offer willingly? For all things come from you, and of your own have we given you." So David says, we are nothing in the vast comparison of the universe. You're the one that gave us the things that we're giving back to be used in the building of the temple. So you, God, are the ultimate source of the very offerings we're making. Verse 15, for we are strangers before you and sojourners, as all our fathers were. Our days on the earth are like a shadow, and there is no abiding. So David acknowledges the temporary nature of life on planet Earth. We're here just for a very brief period of time in Earth's history. We're like a shadow. We're like a vapor, if you will, as it kind of shows up in the wisdom literature later. So David is very well aware of that because he knows that he's in his last years. He's in his upper 60s, but he's got a lot of serious health problems at this point. Verse 16, oh, he who is our God, all this abundance that we have provided for building you a house for your holy name comes from your hand and is all your own. See, that's the way we should look at our offerings to God's work. We give, even in the church, I think traditionally, the thing that the Israelis were expected to give, and that is the tithe, a tenth of what we take in from our work. But honestly, everything that we get should belong to God. And we're only giving a small portion of it. Verse 17, I know, my God, that you test the heart and have pleasure in uprightness. In the uprightness of my heart, I have freely offered all these things, and now I have seen your people who are present here offer freely and joyously to you. So David says, I know that I owe you 100% of what I have. But here today, I have given you tons and tons of material that's going to be used in the building of the temple. And then we've seen your people respond by giving generously into the same project. Verse 18, oh, he who is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, our fathers, keep forever such purposes and thoughts in the hearts of your people and direct their hearts toward you. So the petition that he makes is, more important than giving these things to the building of the temple is that we give ourselves to you. And that's always been the case, folks. God is more interested in you and me giving ourselves to him than he is about any donation, any offering, any sacrifice that we might give. It's not about the stuff we can give. It's about the us that we can give. Verse 19, grant to Solomon, my son, a whole heart that he may keep your commandments, your testimonies, and your statutes, performing all, and that he may build the palace for which I have made provision. So he's praying for Solomon right there in Solomon's presence, that Solomon will do a good job at being king and at building the temple, which is the palace of God on earth. And then David said to all the assembly, bless he who is your God. And then all the assembly blessed he who is the God of their fathers and bowed their heads and paid homage to he who is and to the king. And so basically David is wrapping everything up with a massive prayer session. He says, let's all pray now. And everybody gets down on their faces. Everybody gets down on their hands and knees and praises God, blesses God. And also they thank God for King David and for King Solomon. Verse 21, they offered sacrifices to he who is, and the next day offered burnt offerings to he who is. So they're making this a two-day affair. And here's the tally of what was offered. 1,000 bulls, 1,000 rams, 1,000 lambs with their drink offerings, and sacrifices in abundance for all Israel. And they ate and they drank before he who is on that day with great gladness. That many animals being offered would feed tens of thousands, maybe a couple of 100,000 people. And that's all part of this worship service that marks the coronation, the second coronation of King Solomon. Because it says here, they made Solomon, the son of David, king the second time. And they anointed him as prince for he who is, and Zadok as priest. So the reason for this second coronation is because the first one was done hastily, because it was an emergency thing that needed to happen because of the Adonijah attempt to become king. But this is the more big official thing. And after that, verse 23, Solomon sat on the throne of he who is as king in the place of David his father, and he prospered, and all Israel obeyed him. So Solomon is not just simply crown prince. He is, in fact, king over united Israel. David, as I've repeatedly said, has got health issues. He's spending a lot of time in bed, away from the throne room. So Solomon is the one that's taking on all of the royal responsibilities now. Verse 24, all the leaders and the mighty men, and also all the sons of King David pledged their allegiance to King Solomon. And he who is made Solomon very great in all the sight of Israel, and bestowed on him such royal majesty as has not been on any king before him in Israel. So he's the biggest thing that's come along since the beginning of Israel as a nation. And so I think it is at this point that we would benefit from going back to the Psalms again and picking up some of the ones that we have not yet studied and not yet experienced the emotion of. And the one I want to start with is one that I think may have been written for this coronation ceremony, and that is Psalm number 2. Psalm number 2. Now, this psalm is quoted in the book of Acts, starting at verse 23, as a reference to how the leadership in Israel, both Jewish and Roman, had kind of stood up against Jesus, but it didn't matter, because Jesus was still going to be God's choice for King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So that's its prophetic application. It's about Jesus. But I would suggest to you that David may have originally written it for this coronation to remind everyone that whether they thought it was customary or traditionally appropriate, Solomon was God's choice for king, and everybody ought to get on board with him, and no one should try to stand against him. And so let's feel the emotion of Psalm number 2. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against he who is and against his anointed. So the anointed is another way of referring to the king of Israel. And so David, or whoever's writing this, because it doesn't actually have David's name attached to it officially, is saying, why is everybody against God and his anointed king? What are they saying? Verse 3, they're saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. Let's get our independence from God and from his king on earth. Well, verse 4, this is God's response. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord, or the Master, holds them in derision. Now, the laughter here is that snicker sort of thing that when you see something that's just ridiculous, it's like, you got to be kidding, right? Well, that's God's response when human leadership tries to stand against his plans. It's like, really? That's how you think you're going to play it? And so verse number 5, then he will speak to them in his fury and terrify them in his wrath. He will terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. So when God puts his king on the throne at Zion, which is just a poetic name for Jerusalem on earth, or it could be a prophetic, poetic reference to Jerusalem of heaven, the heavenly hill. When God puts his leader in place, everybody else needs to get on board with that. Verse 7, I will tell of the decree. He who is said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Now, this is quoted a couple of different places in the New Testament, book of Hebrews as well, that God has said this about Jesus. You are my son, today I've begotten you. Now, when we hear the word begotten in our English language, a lot of times we think about the physical stuff, that Jesus was conceived in the body of Mary and was a human being. But there is also this idea that it's a selection process. In other passages we've already been looking at, God had said to David, your sons will be my son. That is, your offspring on the throne will be my son, and I will be his father. This is the idea of the divine kingship. And David was quoting from that not too long ago when we were seeing what he had to say about the coronation of David or of Solomon. So here, if this is a psalm about Solomon, this is a reminder that God is the one that said, this guy on the throne, he's my son. He's my king. Accept him. But in reference to Jesus, you might remember that on several occasions, God spoke from heaven and said, you are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased, or this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. That is God's declaration. This is my son, and you need to get on board with my plan through him. Verse number 8, ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. Now, that's addressed to Jesus, or prophetically in the Old Testament time, to Solomon, that the nations, the Gentiles, will be part of Solomon's kingdom. And in Jesus being addressed, it's not just simply the Jewish people that come to faith in Jesus Christ, it's the Gentiles as well. And the gospel goes out to the ends of the earth. Verse 9, you shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. The word break here is in some of the manuscripts actually the word for shepherd or rule. And this is referenced in the New Testament in the book of Revelation about Jesus, that in his millennial reign, he will have a rod of iron where he's expecting the mortals who are making up their minds about him in the millennial period, to toe the line. And if they don't, they will be judged. They will be broken like a potter's vessel. That's a reference to the idea when a potter is throwing a pot on his wheel. If he has a problem with it, if the clay has got some issue that makes it not useful, it's his option to break it, to shatter it, even after it's been baked. If he finds something wrong with it, he can use it for something different than what was the original intention, or he may even just break it up and use it for scrap. And so in the millennial period, Jesus will be sorting people out as to whether or not they are going to be part of the eternal kingdom. Verse number 10, "Now therefore, O kings, be wise, be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve he who is with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son." And the idea is show your respect by getting down and kissing the feet of Solomon, or thinking about Jesus on his throne, getting down before him. "Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is kindled quickly. Blessed are those who take refuge in him." So the two places that I think that the application is here is that David may have been warning people, get on board with the Solomon kingship or suffer the consequences of God's judgment. But more importantly, from a prophetic viewpoint, everybody needs to get on board with the kingship of Jesus as the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the eternal King, or suffer the consequences from that rejection of him. All right, we're going to stay in the book of Psalms for a while. Let's go through some of the Psalms that actually have David's name attached to them that may have been written during these final 3 years of David's transition. Psalm number 5. And as I always tell you, feel these Psalms. Let the emotion get to you on it. "To the choir master for the flutes, a psalm of David. Give ear to my words, O he who is. Consider my groaning. Give attention to the sound of my cry, my King and my God, for to you do I pray." Now, David, as his body is failing him, may have prayed that type of prayer all the time now. "O he who is, in the morning you hear my voice. In the morning I prepare a sacrifice for you, and I watch. For you are not a God who delights in wickedness. Evil may not dwell with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all evildoers." The idea of hate here is the opposite of love, and love is all about commitment. So God is not committed to those who are doing evil. "You destroy those who speak lies. He who is abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. But I, through the abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house. I will bow down towards your holy temple in the fear of you." Now the temple, the physical, permanent place of worship, was not built until after David's death. So he may have been either thinking about the place where the Ark of the Covenant was in the palace, or maybe the tabernacle itself, or he may have been thinking about the stuff that he'd been designing and kind of formulating this psalm ahead of temple worship. "Lead me, O he who is, in your righteousness, because of my enemies. Make your way straight before me." So he wants to live a righteous lifestyle, even in the midst of unrighteous people. And he asked God, "Make your way straight in front of me." This is kind of similar to the model prayer when we are praying to God, "Lead us not into temptation." You know, don't take us down those paths that we might get in trouble in, but rather lead us in your way so that we can pursue your kingdom and its attentive its attendant righteousness, and then you can add all the other things to us. Verse number 9, "For there is no truth in their mouth. Their inmost self is destruction. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue." So he's, you know, coming down on a lot of the bad people of this world. "Make them bear their guilt, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. Because of the abundance of their transgression, cast them out, for they have rebelled against you. So David is praying that God will deal with those that have become enemies of the truth. Let them be judged to keep them from spreading all of the dangerous activities that they're involved in throughout the entire kingdom and throughout the world. Verse 11, let all who take refuge in you rejoice. And some of this has got that idea of everybody that comes to the worship here at the temple that's being built, let them find refuge in you. And let them ever sing for joy. One of the interesting things about the temple that David designed, it will become clear to us that it had music going on in it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you got up in the middle of the night and you happened to be close to the temple, there'd be singing going on. There'd be music going on, and you could join in with that. So let them ever sing for joy and spread your protection over them, that those who love your name may exult in you. So David asks that everybody that loves the Lord, everybody that comes to the Lord, let the Lord just kind of put his protection around them, his cloak of acceptance, so that they could keep that up, so that they could keep exalting God, that is, bringing God to the forefront of everything they say and do. For you bless the righteous, O he who is. You cover him with favor as with a shield. And David can hardly help himself. He likes to use military verbiage whenever he composes his psalms because he was a military guy. But I do like this idea that if you want to be blessed by God, then you need to bless God yourself. So the next time that you say, God bless me, or God bless America, remember that it's important that we bless God first, because he's due that, and then he will reciprocate.